Welcome to Behavioral Health Today, a podcast brought to you by the Triad Network. This podcast is designed to share trending topics occurring within the world and our communities and bring them a behavioral and mental health perspective.
Welcome to Behavioral Health Today. I'm your host, Dr. Graham Taylor. My guest today is Tom O'Neill. Tom is a president and CEO of CogniView Incorporated, a neuroscience company focused on cognitive health. With over three decades of experience in driving commercial success, Tom has a track record of propelling growth, ensuring operational excellence, and enhancing customer satisfaction across a range of sectors, including consumer, pharmaceuticals, medical devices, surgical, and diagnostics. Tom earned a BS in business administration and marketing from the University of Akron and currently serves on the Creek Women's Health Board of Directors. We're excited to have Tom with us today to discuss clinical assessment and his tool, CogniView. Tom, welcome to our show.
Hey, thanks, Graham. I appreciate being here.
Really nice to have you. You know, Tom, I know that every good product originates with a need being identified. And when it came to early detection of cognitive impairment, what were some of the things you were seeing in the current industry that inspired you to create CogniView?
Yeah, so first, just to set the stage, I wasn't the developer of the original technology. Dr. Duffy, out of the University of Rochester, a brilliant neurologist, neuroscientist, developed the technology, carried it through the FDA as part of the de novo process, which basically means it was the first of its kind, right? And then they ran out of funding, and that's where I came in. So a new investor came in, brought me in to commercialize the product after it had gotten through the FDA clearance process. But to answer your question, and you're probably really aware of this, but the need that it fills is cognitive testing, neuropsych testing has been paper and pencil for 30 or 40 years, which is really, if you think about it, with all the technology and where technology has gone, the fact that we're still doing what's called a MOCA, these are going to be acronyms, but MOCA or MMSE, the SLUMS, the MINICOG, all of those are still question and answer, even if they're put on an iPad, they're still question and answer, and they need somebody to administer them. They need somebody to score them. So there was a big gap. And what comes with those, Graham, is a lot of human error, variability, bias that plays a part because they are administered, because they are question and answer. So what Dr. Duffy was creating was something that is self-administered, self-scored. It's not question and answers. It's a series of 10 exercises in 10 minutes. They use something called adaptive psychophysics. By exercises, I mean no question answers, but there's only one interaction for that patient with the technology. It's the cognitive wheel. It looks like a joystick in the middle. And they're just moving a circle over the right answer. And it's adapting to that individual's performance. So that at the end, it gives you a score, an overall score and subdomain scores. We take 130,000 data points and summarize it into a really simple, easy to read report for the patient and the doctor.
I would love to kind of take a little bit of a deep dive more into what the patient actually experiences, because it is a fascinating approach. You guys actually have on your website some really cool videos of people going through it. And it gives someone a sense of what to really experience. But we'll ask kind of maybe for a verbal illustration of it in just a moment. I want to highlight though for you, I've done some neuropsych testing, and it's all pretty much paper and pencil, some performance pieces, you know, but for the most part, it is just what you just described. And there are, you know, there is room for various things that happen. And I think a different way to measure some things, I think, is a very needed opportunity here to give patients. But I also know that early detection, you know, identifying the onset of cognitive decline early in one's process can be so beneficial to patients and the physicians caring for them as well. What have you noticed about the benefits of some of the early detection on both sides, the patient side and the doctor side?
So it's a great question, Graham. Here's what I'd say is it should be the fifth vital sign from our perspective. Okay. And it isn't. And it isn't for some very specific reasons. And I say this having been in healthcare for 30 years and having worked with specialties across the array of different medical specialties, including primary care, internal medicine, And there's really three reasons why it's not the standard of care. Okay. It's not the standard of care, first, because our primary care and internal medicine docs, family, they get 10 minutes a patient, right? So they don't have time. They're triaging, right? They're dealing with things like diabetes and heart issues, and they're handling those things. They're not getting to cognitive issues. So the first is time, and just, it's a factory, right? They got to get through as many patients as they can, not because they're bad people, but because literally the systems have set them up that way, right? The second thing is, even if they do it, right, the payers, which I always think is interesting, we call them payers because they do everything you can not to pay, right? So the payers will pay the specialists, right? The neuros, the neuropsychs, the psychs, but they won't necessarily pay primary care. It really is payer dependent, okay? So some payers pay primary care, some payers won't. So that's the second reason. The third is, up until recently, we'll talk a little bit about this, I'm sure, but there was no medication. There was nothing. There wasn't a prescription they could write, right? So, and if you think of primary care docs, that's what they're used to intervening and helping. To your question, what's the benefit of early screening, early diagnosis is the modifiable risk factors, diet, exercise, lifestyle, mindfulness, hearing, vision, all these things, sleep, all these things have an impact on somebody's cognitive function. And if you can adjust those, empower that patient to adjust those, they can slow the progression or stop the progression before it becomes something permanent like dementias up to and including Alzheimer's. Part of the challenge with that is when I talk to the doctors or when I've talked to the payers is they'll say, hey, Tom, we already counsel our patients to eat right and exercise. I said, I understand that, but let me give you a different perspective. I tell them, I say, listen, I didn't start watching my diet or taking my cholesterol meds till I saw my number, right? Till I saw my cholesterol number. I said, here, we're giving them a report and it's an inflection point. It's a wake-up call that says, hey, I got something going on. I need to change my behavior. And by the way, the diet, exercise, lifestyle, mindfulness, all that stuff isn't a cognitive thing. That's the CDC Healthy Brains Initiative. That's the World Health Organization. That is a number of large, very good, very smart organizations that are focused on health that have come up with those. The Lancet and others have all validated it. But there are those modifiable risk factors. And in my mind, if doctors can empower patients through awareness of how they score with the assessment, then all of a sudden it's in the patient's hands to be able to do something about it.
You bet. I think what you're saying around the numbers too, I think that makes something real.
Yeah.
In a new way. It quantifies something, but when you see something written down or something in ink, it puts another level of reality to it that oftentimes we begin to pay more attention to. And I love that idea of early detection, early intervention. It allows that, you know, the patient to address, like you said, modifiable risk factors, things that they can have some control over sooner, mitigate some of the things and potentially change this course of decline. And you're also suggesting that it allows a healthcare provider to develop a plan with a patient, you know, and the caregiver, there's someone in place.
Yeah.
So if they're going to go down this journey of, let's say, a cognitive decline, it's going to be their best life in that process.
There are specific codes that have been developed by the Alzheimer's Association that they advocated with CMS. And got through around the care planning code, right? So it doesn't have to be the MD. It can be their NP or PA, the patient and a caregiver. And there's some time elements to it. There's some diagnosis element to it, but that's an opportunity to do exactly what you're saying is if they've already gotten there, right, to where it is Alzheimer's or some form of dementia, then let's figure out how to help them live their best life while they're still with us. Mentally and physically.
We'll be right back after word from our sponsor.
Nearly 9 in 10 registered voters believe the nation faces a mental health crisis, according to a new USA Today Suffolk University poll. Americans are more concerned than ever about their mental health. Mental Health First Aid provides the resources and training to identify, understand, and respond to signs of mental health and substance use challenges. It provides the confidence and skills needed to offer life-saving assistance, and it provides peace of mind. Our experts provide mental health first aid training for adults teens, caregivers, veterans, law enforcement, EMS, and school faculty. Mental health concerns are on the rise, but evidence-based training through Mental Health First Aid can make a difference. Visit mentalhealthfirstaid.org to find a course near you, or email hello@mentalhealthfirstaid.org to schedule a training. Courses are available for individuals, groups, organizations, and companies of all sizes. Visit mentalhealthfirstaid.org and make a difference in your community.
You mentioned something earlier that's just a reality, whether it's the payer, the doctor's time. You know, doctors are so loaded with patients, yeah, and the time given for detection is very challenging. And cognitive health can be a very subtle thing to try and assess. And you can use, you know, the mini mental status and have them remember, you know, certain things. And that's good. It's a good start. But there's so much going on in that.
Yep.
Session. I remember I gave a talk to some docs one time, and I was talking about what you say in your appointment with them, even, you know, in 5 minutes. Basically, the research is showing, you have to go, I'm diving way back into my memory banks, but something like they're only going to hear 50% of what you say. Mm-hmm. And then they're only going to remember 50% of that 50%.
Yep.
You know, by the time they leave your office, and by the time they get to the car, they're going to lose 50% of that 50%, which is 50% of the information they got at the very beginning. So there's this decreasing amount of what you can get, and they're going to forget. They're anxious. They're coming in. They want to build a relationship with their practitioner. And there's so much going on. What your program does that I really like is that it begins to break these things down. And I maybe we can shift a little bit and go back into some specifics about that. This is a proprietary FDA approved technology.
Yep.
That's based, like you said, on adaptive psychophysics, and it's a self-administered computerized assessment, which removes, like you said earlier, which is a very important piece, the bias that can be associated,
yep,
with more traditional cognitive assessments. And mm-hmm. like you said, it provides 10 different exercises. It measures 4 performances over 4 cognitive, you know, domains and yep. 2 performance parameters. Walk us through a little bit more. The patient comes in, what yep. they get to experience, and what do we get to see as a result of this?
Yeah. Absolutely. We'll answer that question. I'll also say, you know, like the mini mental status exam, which you talked about yeah. many times, and this is what our parents, our grandparents, our aunts and uncles get really good at, is they can fake it, right?
Oh, so
they
absolutely.
Can fake it for 10 minutes. They can fake yeah. it for a 20-minute, 30-minute sure. Zoom call with you, or, you know, you can go online and find a MoCA or MMSE. Yeah. And they're good at studying it so that when they go in, they can get through it, right?
They develop a good short game. You
yeah.
know, to and get through it, things.
Absolutely. And you can't with ours, because ours adjusts. It's yeah. never the same exercises. Same exercise, but different format. But let me tell you what that patient experiences. So think of it like a oversized computer. And it's only, there's only, again, one joystick in the middle, and that goes around in circles, left or right. And that is the only interaction the patient has to our technology. There's an introductory video. Every patient that sits in front of it gets the same introductory video, okay? So there's no bias and no, you know, variability in how it's right. delivered, right? If I ask, if you have 10 people in your office, 10 staff, and all of them are delivering a MOC or MMSE or even a MINICOG, they're all going to do it differently. We wanted to remove that variability. Yeah. So everybody gets the same introductory video, and then it rolls right into the 10 exercises in 10 minutes. The first two exercises, the first one is motor ability. Okay. The reason why we do motor ability, it adapts the rest of the subtest to your motor skills. A 15-year-old student athlete is going to be different than a 35-year-old with MS versus my parents who are 79 and maybe have arthritis, right? Or Parkinson's. So it adapts the rest of the, it's not part of your score, the first test, but what it does is it adapts the rest of the subtest to your motor ability. The second subtest is visual salience. So again, not part of the overall score, but you'll see we add complexity to the subtest, denigration of the optics over the course of the 10 subtests. And so we're measuring your visual acuity so that we can then again adapt it. Then we take you through 4 memory and 4 perception tests, right? And letter, shape, word, and motion. Mm-hmm. And each one of those is adapting to your ability. So the better you do, the harder it gets. And the less well you do, the easier it gets. And the best way to say it is we're trying to find your threshold, your failure point. So there will be people that come out of it and go, man, that was hard. And they score really well, right? And it's because it's intentionally working to find your threshold. And then at the end of the 10 minutes, it gives an overall summary, that report that you're referencing, right? So it'll show the memory, executive function, discrimination, visual, spatial, and it'll have the reaction time and speed processing, those scores in your normative range. Right. So we're going to give you a normative range based on your age of where you should fall within that subtest. And then we give you an overall score. Okay. So that overall score is the one that you look at and go, all right, and I'm going to do this not by normative range, because it'll adjust slightly based on age. Is if it's 75 and above, no impairment. 50 to 74, mild impairment. And below 50, moderate to significant impairment. And it's really, that's what's interesting. And that's when we've done this, and we've done it side by side with MoCA or MMSE and others. There's not an adult on this planet that I know of that wants to go take a question and answer test, have somebody administer it to them, right? And then score it in front of them.
Yes.
Here, there's nobody else in the room. It's self-administered, it's self-scored, and it comes through. And when we ask the patients, like, what did you like about it? They're like, well, it felt like an arcade game.
Yes.
Like, it's kind of the gamification of it with a significant depth of science. I also want to clarify something. You had said FDA approved. We're a class 2 device, so we're FDA cleared. Not approved. Okay. It's just an important regulatory differentiation. I want to make sure. So that's the experience that the patients have. And from a doctor standpoint, from your standpoint, you don't have to have staff administering it. You don't have to have staff scoring it. Yeah. You know, you're going to see this, you're going to see the results before you ever walk into the, to meet with the patient. So you'll have the report, you'll have the results before you go in there and be able to figure out what your game plan is to talk to them.
Kind of equivalent to the lab test that ideally gets done before the patient is seen, or the x-rays or the other scans that can be done, so you can make some informed decisions when you see the patient. You referenced 130,000 data points go into the assessment, the report, the numbers. Tell us a little bit more about that part.
Yeah. So if you think about it, we're measuring every 1/12 of a second. Okay. Mm-hmm. So through the 10 minutes. So remember, the first two are adjusting for motor and visual, but then every one of the subtests are measuring every 1/12 of a second and adapting the other tests to your ability. So again, the better you do, the harder each one of the subtests gets. So there are that 130,000 data points through the 10 minutes that roll up to an overall score into those subtest results.
Excellent.
For the doctor, we also give them a second page, which shows the tracer reports. And the tracer reports are literally a by second example of, if you think about it like a line chart, it looks almost like a cardiac chart, right? So it shows how they're doing throughout it. And you'll see if they drop off, this elicits a question from the doctor, right? Like, they may see it and they may see, oh, it looks like you got to a certain point and then you dropped off. Let's talk about why that might be. Maybe it's lost attention. And this is why we try to set it up the right way, so that the patient doesn't have their phone in their hand, that they're in a nice quiet room. Because if we're measuring every 1/12 of a second, say a patient looks away or looks, that can make a difference.
You bet. Right? You bet. Do the reports come with a narrative description of what each category is suggesting for that patient specifically? So the doc has that already laid out for them?
It is. So there's a third page, and that third page literally outlines each one of the subtests. Definition of kind of each one of those subtests, and then the domains and what goes into those domain scores. Because we want to make sure that, listen, there's not a doctor I've ever met that wants to look like they don't have an answer when the patient asks. So we try to give them everything within those three pages.
Perfect. This one is, again, self-administered and 10 minutes. You've also got the CogniVue Thrive device.
This
is an abbreviated.
Yeah. Yep.
Cognitive screening. Tell us a little bit about this one.
Yeah. So thank you for asking. So if you think about it, when I started, we had the one 10-minute assessment.
Yeah.
And then, I quickly realized, like, we don't have within our health system in the U.S. and really in the world enough of the frontline doctors to take care of this cognitive issue. We also realized that in allied health, whether it's the audiologist, the optometrist, and the pharmacist, there's components to that. So we wanted to build a screening tool or technology for them. So think about the cognitive clarity. It's a 10-minute assessment, and that's really for the MD or the neuroscientist or the neuropsych. The 5-minute screening is for the audiologist, the optometrist, the pharmacist. And the way I want you to think about it is, again, all self-administered, self-scored, all the similar, you know, context to all of that. But as an example, we hear with our ears, but we process those sounds with our brain, right? So the most modifiable risk factor for cognitive function before it becomes Alzheimer's or dementia is hearing. So we've sold a significant number of devices into audiologists so that they can have a bigger healthcare conversation with that patient than just your hearing aids, or that you need some hearing aids, right? And so we know from the from that market, as an example, it takes a patient 7 years, a consumer 7 years, before they go in to get their hearing checked. And it's generally because, you know, my wife's yelling at me and telling me I got hearing issues, right? So then when I go in, let's just say it's 50% of the people actually end up walking out with hearing aids for various reasons. But when all of a sudden you can have a conversation as an audiologist, as an ENT, as a hearing information specialist, that's not just about hearing, but look at how you've scored on some significant or important cognitive components, right? And make it a bigger conversation. Now all of a sudden, again, inflection point, right, for that patient, you know, besides your wife, you know, pushing you on the shoulder and go, I told you were having memory issues because you weren't hearing me, you know, like those are real, right? So it gives them, it gives those doctors, those audiologists, a very important tool for them to have a bigger conversation about your health with them.
And what a great impact they can have too. You know, not everybody starts with a neuropsychologist or gerontologist, you know, and maybe, you know, a PCP doesn't necessarily maybe do the, you know, the neuropsych, you know, mini eval for whatever reason, or maybe, you know, they don't get the readings from it, but someone's going to go see an audiologist or their pharmacist. And these are other points of contact that could be providing a great service that can then help coordinate care that the person might not otherwise have received had they not had this tool in this other doctor's office. I can even see that being in maybe assisted living homes, you know, as well.
Absolutely.
So a lot of application for this.
A lot of application. And in the pharmacy as an example, you know, there are a number of medications that have a cognitive component to them where it'll have it'll drive some cognitive issue. It's called the Beers list, but there's that Beers list is something that shows, you know, hundreds of medications that all have some type of cognitive influence, you know, and not in a positive way, but in a challenging way. And those pharmacists work with the doctors every day. So it's a really good idea to screen there and then let your doctor take it a step further. Many times what happens with the doctor with the annual wellness visit that, you know, that they have at their disposal for those that are over 65, it's more of a check the box thing. And again, not because they're bad doctors, they're brilliant and they're so patient focused, but they're trying to get through their 10 minutes. So they'll do a mini cog, which is like three questions, which this is not a Tom O'Neill saying this or CogniView. This is the American Association of Neurologists have said the mini cog is just fraught with bias, error and human error and variability, and it shouldn't be used. But it's what they use because there's no specifications of what the cognitive test should be.
Really good. I want to go back over something, and I'm curious about this other piece. You know, the results allow for there to be a description on page 3 that the physician gets to have some answers. Is there also in the report recommendations for post-assessment treatment and follow-up?
Yeah. So not specifically. What we have is what we call the CogniWell program. Okay. And that CogniWell program is a one page, and it does talk about those modifiable risk factors. So we don't want the patient to just walk out with nothing, whether they're that CogniWell comes at a pharmacist or an audiologist or optometrist or at an MD's office.
Yeah.
We give them something. So you see the report, but they also go out and say, okay, these are the things I can do to empower myself.
Yes.
So they get the CogniWell program. I think when they're in the MD's office, that's up to the MD because the MD is going to look at their chart and go, all right, do we have, and by the way, many times primary care doctors are reticent to diagnose Alzheimer's or dementia. So they'll say things like confusion or had difficulty finding their way home. They won't diagnose it. So they'll really kind of stay away from that. And that's a challenge too, because that doesn't help get that patient the intervention that they may need.
You know, you're suggesting something here that oftentimes isn't spoken about. And, you know, delivering bad news is a hard thing.
Yeah, it is.
Delivering, you know, real news is a hard thing. And sometimes we hedge a wee bit. Well, you know, maybe just confusion and maybe, you know, have a tray for your keys, you know, and maybe develop some of these habits without maybe naming something that, if named with some numbers to back it and some descriptions around what's going on, can really help the patient develop some.
100% agree with you.
Yeah, it's such a good, and it's hard. You know, the doctor's in a hard place sometimes. It's like, you know, diagnosing other things, like say a cancer or, and cognitive decline is a huge thing here. But what's kind of benefiting the doctor as well is they are given an objective measure, just like you would say your cholesterol is high. I don't have a hard time saying that because the numbers say it. And here I get to say, hey, you know what? We're beginning to notice some things here, but we're going to talk about what we can do early on and develop a course and plan for your journey here that's going to help you be in control in a number of ways. But I get to share it with you based on the numbers that allow me to have a little bit of a professional space to say it without that relational piece being so difficult for me.
Yeah, 100% agree. And I want you to think, and you know this, but for many of your listeners that aren't doctors, it's think of dementia this way, Alzheimer's, it's inflammation, circulation, and toxins. Right. It's not one issue, right? It's a multifaceted issue that drives that. So you and I both know vascular dementia is the biggest issue, right? That causes the most dementia. Well, if that's the case, then, and you have this report, we're not going to tell you whether it's vascular dementia, but if you have vascular dementia, you have high blood pressure and you're a smoker, and now all of a sudden you got diabetes. Now there's stuff you should do. And there's this inflection point again, which is the report.
Yeah, that's really great. Well, I'm curious, what kind of feedback are you receiving from practitioners and as well as patients?
Yeah, so really positive feedback, right? And both from patients and practitioners. The thing that, I'm an older guy, right? So I'm 55. I've been in healthcare for 30 years. What I will tell you is that, again, no matter what specialty is, getting doctors to change behavior is probably one of the bigger challenges, right? So getting them to bring a new technology in or do it differently because of those three reasons we talked about: time, getting paid for it, and then also what do they prescribe for it? I think those are still challenges. I think those are real challenges. So I think for this, most of the time, it's pushed to the neurologist, the geriatrician, the neuropsych, the neuroscientist. I think it's pushed to them. The challenge is you're probably 6 months out to getting to see a neurologist. Yeah. You're probably 9 months out to see a neuropsych, right? So it becomes this bottleneck. And sometimes that's already too late to get to that point.
Yeah. As you're receiving this feedback, is there a story that stands out to you of maybe a practitioner working with someone who was able, you know, to be detected early in their cognitive issues and maybe the benefit of experiencing this treatment planning early on?
Yeah. So it actually happened in an audiologist office. And it was an MD that went to see the audiologist and they scored. And no way was their age appropriate, like to what their score was. Their score was super low, like in the 30s. Okay. And the doctor that was taking the test knew there was a problem, but just didn't know what was going on. But because they got that report, they then went to the neurologist. They then had a scan. They had a bunch of mini strokes and like a year before and just didn't know it. And now was getting treatment for it. They came back to the audiologist and said, I got to tell you, I would have just continued the path I was on had I not come in for hearing aids, and never would I have thought I was going to get a cognitive screening while I was in my audiologist. That then would help another doctor at MD, you know, identify and diagnose what had happened to me.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I was going to ask just in follow-up to that, I know we're kind of winding down in our time today, but maybe a follow-up or kind of a takeaway message rather.
Yeah.
About, you know, practitioners considering, you know, this kind of assessment tool in their practice, or maybe even, you know, patients that want to have access to this in some kind of facility where they can go get some baseline measures, which allows them to have a starting point to watch some things.
Yeah, I think if you're a doctor that wants to get involved, certainly you can go to our website and you will get you a device and get you up and running really quickly. If you're a patient, like, go to the website, print our information off, and be, like I've always told patients this, be your own best advocate. If you're not your own best advocate, then nobody's going to be. And so you're going to maybe go have to really push a doctor to bring a new technology in. And by the way, I'm not even saying that you have to use CogniVue. Just drive the conversation that you want a cognitive assessment.
You bet. Right?
So if it is the old paper and pencil and the MoCA, I mean, that's fine. That's better than nothing. And maybe starts you on the path. Now, I want it to be CogniVue, but I want you as a patient to get treated and diagnosed and treated while it's MCI before it becomes something more permanent.
Yeah, really good. I appreciate that. Well, I would love our listeners to be able to learn more about you and your work with CogniVue as we follow up with today's show. How can they get in touch with you and find out more?
Listen, just go to our website, www.cogniVue.com. And there's a place in there that you can go and you can request information. You can request a trial. Our folks will call you right away. You know, we do all the work for you, right? We set it up. We train your staff, the language to use with your patients. We make it hopefully as simple as possible to integrate it into your practice.
Well, I so have enjoyed the show. I love your passion around this. This is a great tool. What a great service being provided. Yeah. So thanks so much for what you're doing. It's been great to have you on the show, Tom. Thanks for joining us today.
Hey, Graham, I really appreciate you having me and taking the time. So thank you.
Appreciate it. I also want to thank you, our listeners, for dropping by and joining Tom and me today. It's always great to have you with us. I'd like to remind you that our episode today, as well as an archive of all of our other podcasts and resource materials, can be found on our webpage at triadhq.com/BHT. Thanks again for being with us today, and we look forward to having you back with us next time on Behavior Health Today.
We appreciate all the support from our community, and if you like our show, one of the best ways you can support it is by giving us a 5-star rating and leaving a review. Behavioral Health Today is a podcast part of the Tribe Network, all rights reserved.